That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said. Well, that's what she said.
Welcome to That's What She Said, conversations with interesting people from the world of sports, music, comedy, and more, talking about their lives, careers, successes, and failures. Hello and welcome to the latest edition of That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. I am Sarah Spain. I'm so pumped for you guys to listen to this episode and my conversation with Cameron Esposito. I have long admired her from afar via social media. She and her spouse, Rhea Butcher, both of them just putting out incredible content, thoughtful, interesting, funny content. Their show, Take My Wife, is hilarious. And I recently reached out to Cameron. I saw she was going to be in Chicago doing stand-up in preparation for an upcoming special. And I said, I really got to come. I don't know how I missed the boat and I didn't get tickets, but is there any chance you can sneak me in? And she very kindly had my husband and I come to the show. Really small room, working through a bunch of very complicated and interesting and serious but funny material. And it all ended up in her new special, Rape Jokes. And I cannot recommend it enough. It is so thought-provoking and interesting and hilarious all at the same time. And she's just such a powerful voice for what's going on right now for women, for everybody, and for LGBTQ people as well. And it's very wide ranging and I highly recommend it. And I love this conversation with her. So I hope you guys enjoy it too.
That's what she said.
Happy to welcome to the podcast, actor and comedian Cameron Esposito. You've seen her on her show, Take My Wife, on Drunk History, Conan, Chelsea Lately, and others. You've heard her on her podcasts, Query and Put Your Hands Together. And you've read her on BuzzFeed and other sites. Her new special, Rape Jokes, is available now on CameronEsposito.com. All the money raised by the special is going to the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. And we're going to talk about that special because I had the pleasure of seeing some of the one of the shows that she was doing to put the content together before the special came out. But I want to start way back, Cameron, because you're an Illinois gal, and you grew up in Western Springs, and you talk about your sort of religious childhood in the set. And I wonder if you could remind us of that childhood.
Yeah, I did. I grew up 15 miles outside Chicago, and in a very, like almost a joke, because we had literally a milkman, you know, and this is like in the 90s.
Yeah, you're not 80 years old.
Yeah, so it was an idyllic place to grow up. I also would say it was very homogeneous, like many of the folks there are from the same demographic background. It's very white. It's very Catholic. There's also a lot of Christian folks that are different denominations, but
diversity.
Not a lot of diversity outside of that. Yeah. I mean, yeah, there were Christians and then there were Catholics.
Yeah,
wow. It was a really diverse place. But you know, I went to Catholic schooling also, which I think it's a specific way of being raised, because when religion is interwoven with world knowledge, you know, like you're learning about history, you're learning what 2 + 2 =, and then you're also learning a particular interpretation of the Bible, and all of those things are being held up as like irrefutable fact.
Right.
That it gets into your bones, you know, it's like, it's just, you can't get it out. It's woven in there. So that was what my childhood was like.
Did you like it at the time? Did you realize how homogenous it was?
Well, I would say I would take the train down to the city. There's a commuter rail that goes through the downtown area in Western Springs. And so I saw other types of folks, but I really wasn't in community with other types
right.
of folks.
Right.
And I think, I mean, really, I loved being Catholic, because for me, it was a way to connect with other people, you know, sharing prayer or being an altar server. Those things were what I've always been looking for, which is human connection. I think as I've grown up, I have wanted to expand the borders of who I connect with. I mean, that just seems to be, I noticed that in myself.
Yeah, I grew up in Lake Forest, and I remember thinking, why would anyone live anywhere else? It's so nice and wonderful and safe and beautiful. And then once I got into the world, I was like, oh, there's people of other races. and different than, you know, have different experiences, and life is so much more interesting than that. But I think when you're younger, it's easy to sort of not realize how much else is out there for you when you grow up somewhere like that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I guess it's like, you know, I was trading. I mean, it was a very safe place to grow up, and in a lot of different ways, but it wasn't really a safe place to grow up and have different ideas mm-hmm. in your head than the people around you, or, you know, I'm gay, to have to be like inherently different. It wasn't like a super safe place for that. So I wonder, you know, when we talk about safety, it's like, I didn't really know who I was, and I wasn't introduced to people that were like me, who were doing fine, and they were functional adults, and they had families and lives and jobs. And I think that, yeah, the trade-off that perceived, like, part of safety, what we're talking about there, is that you're also, I don't know, like, I didn't get to hear a lot of different ideas outside of Catholicism. I didn't get to read books by different types of authors. I didn't get to, like, eat different food. I literally didn't eat anything that wasn't Italian food until I went to college. You know, it was like that kind of thing.
So you got to Boston College, and you were like, yeah. I love religion. I'm going to keep it going by majoring in theology and English. What was the goal there? What did you want to do?
I wanted to be a priest, I think. I mean, I hadn't really thought it through because I am a woman and one cannot be a priest if one is a Catholic. But there was something about the, you know, I had been an altar server, which is like a priest assistant, and I had been a Eucharistic minister, which is you're the person who gives communion, like, next mm-hmm. to the priest. So I had been those things. And, you know, when I thought about what I liked in the world, I liked talking to people about what was important to me and listening to what was important to them. And because of the framework that I grew up with, faith was that thing. It was like the most important thing I could think of to talk to people about. Like, what do you believe and why are we all here? So that's really what I wanted to study. And I think the end game would have been for me to be some sort of faith leader, but there wasn't really an avenue for that that I saw. So I certainly worked around a lot of nuns, but I mean, I didn't really believe that celibacy was something that would have ever worked for me or is necessary for anybody, to be honest.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I think it should be a personal choice, not a mandate. And there were a lot of different things that I realized did not work for me. But at first, I was like, maybe this is where I will find what I'm looking for.
So you also played rugby and did improv, and I would imagine perhaps, but not necessarily, the people involved in those activities were not the same people in your theology classes and potentially thinking about going into the ministry.
Hey, good job. You, like, deduced. I was just talking about this with somebody yesterday, which is that, you know, the first identity I think I had was really as an athlete. Because you and I aren't too far apart in age. I think I'm a little older than you.
No, you're slightly younger than me.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, we're part of the first, like, post-Title IX generation.
Yeah.
So that means, like, our moms didn't necessarily play sports, but kind of everybody in our generation did. And I don't mean, like, club travel teams that you had to pay to be a part of. I mean even something like participation in gym class. There was just a different expectation on women because we were also allowed to be there.
Right.
So I think, you know, like, as a kid, I played basketball and soccer and I swam and I played softball, and that was really how I identified. And then when I found comedy and, like you're saying, rugby, and, like, that was a, like, I kind of eventually stopped playing rugby the same year that I started doing comedy. Really, that's true. It's also the same year that I started dating women. I think there was just, like, a phase, of, like, an identity switch there, where I didn't really know about the arts because sports were accessible to me. I could understand what sports were, but I didn't know anything about the arts, really.
Yeah. So you leave Boston College and you've sort of started to date women. You're into improv and comedy. But you still at the time go to University of Chicago taking a class, still thinking you're going to use your background to do some sort of social work. When did you realize that that was not going to be the end goal?
A woman told me, hey, thanks, this woman. I literally can't remember her name. Do you have people in your life that you're like, that person?
Yes. I have a book, and I'm like, I could not name anything about it other than this one part about Bobcat Goldthwait that changed my life, and that is a real thing.
Do you know Bobcat? Have you ever met him?
No, I haven't, but reading about him in a book that I bought when I first moved to L.A. that was like, How to Be an Actress 101, really affected my career.
That's amazing. He's a friend.
Nice. I'll have to have him on the podcast.
Yeah, and he's a beautiful soul. So I'm sure whatever you read was great. But there was a woman who said to me, she was a returning student, so she was a little bit older. You know, I was like 20, whatever age I would have been, 25 or something like that, in grad school for social work. And a woman who was maybe in her 40s, and she just kind of pulled me to the side and was like, hey, I don't know if you know this, but there is no like age cap on social work. Like, you can actually come back and do this later, but I hear you talk in class about how you love to do comedy at night, and like that actually seems like something that does relate to youth. Like that's a job you should maybe get into earlier, because like social work will be here. That was fantastic advice. Like, she's totally right. It's much harder to enter the entertainment industry at 45 than it is to like go back and get your social work degree, because we always need social workers. It's like an unpraised and difficult job, as opposed to literally the opposite, which is Hollywood. Just overpraised and still difficult, but maybe a little less.
That's right. So how did you decide when you made that choice? What was the first step of actual career in comedy?
So I already kind of had a career in comedy, but because I didn't have a ton of, well, like my sister was a ballet dancer in my youth. So I was an athlete, I was a jock, and she was a dancer. So my understanding of the arts was really through that. And I didn't know about the industry side of things, and I didn't know that you could kind of become a professional, have your own small business, which is what I sort of have now. I didn't know about all that side. And the first step was, I mean, I was already working professionally. I got my first job working professionally in comedy the day after I graduated from college. Started working at an improv theater, and so I was already getting paid to do it, but I just didn't take it seriously. I guess I kind of thought about it like it was an after-school activity, even though I wasn't in school anymore, where I was just like, I'm a hobbyist, even though I was getting paid and I was having a lot of positive feedback. I guess I didn't see anybody like me in the groups of people I was working with, and I just didn't know what the potential would be.
Right. So, I mean, there's a lot of conversations about being a woman in comedy, and it's still one of many industries where it feels like there's some barriers still up. Did you feel like there's a significant added on difficulty of being a lesbian woman in comedy?
I guess there's a couple things going on here. First of all, I think it is totally great to talk about the difficulty of being a woman or to belong to any marginalized demographic and do the job that I do.
Right.
Because what I hope people would take from it is me saying to other people, other women, I believe that your job is also difficult. Talking like that is a perennial topic, what it is like being a woman in comedy. I get asked about that so much. And I think what we're learning right now, and what I've always known, but I guess we're like shining a light on it for the first time, is like, yeah, man, it like sucks to be a woman and go to work anywhere. Like,
yeah.
People don't know how to treat you for no reason. Like, you know, we're seeing all these stories being written, and they're like deliberately incendiary stories that are clickbait. But I just mean people being like, well, I don't even know if I should have female coworkers anymore. If
right.
I'm constantly going to be accused of harassment. And it's like, maybe you should work a little bit more on your office behavior if you think you will be accused of harassment. Like, maybe that's actually a conversation you should have with yourself and own, because that's not coming from, that's not somebody else putting that on you. That's like, how were you not examining this in the past? Like, holy crap.
Right.
You know? And so, anyway, that's how I feel about being a woman in comedy. It sucks. It's really hard. People don't take you seriously. You don't begin, you're not like given the benefit of the doubt. You're not given respect. You're not advanced at the same speed that the men around you are. You know, you can always be objectified by the audience or by your fellow comics. And that's not necessarily true for dudes who do my job. But that is true for every woman who works. Mm. So,
yeah,
I see you, other people who have jobs.
It's the same thing with women in sports, right? It's like we answer that question over and over, and you never want to sound like a victim because you're making it, you're doing it. But you also don't want to shrug it off so that those that follow after you, when they come across barriers, think, oh, well, I should quit then. Because anybody who made it probably didn't have all this in front of them. And, you know, there's still a need to, like, openly talk about some of the stuff that we haven't before. Because I think people are still shocked to discover, you know, the Me Too movement is for so many people just shining a light on something that women have known for such a long time.
I think that's such a good point. And I, by the way, I see, you know, what your life is like on the internet. I see the public side of what you show people on Twitter, and I can really relate to it because I think what you're saying is totally right. Just the idea of mentioning, like, no, there's a real sense of unsafety. Like, I definitely am viewed as an outsider. I'm supposed to wear different clothes that other people aren't expected to wear. You know, like, I mean, it's not a one thing that happens to you. It's a daily practice of, like, talking yourself into having enough confidence to do the job you're already good enough to get paid to do, you know? So, like,
right.
But then if you acknowledge that, then, you know, the other side of things, the person that's receiving that, that doesn't want to listen or doesn't want to be made uncomfortable, blames you for making them uncomfortable. Like, you are guilting me. And it's like, I wish you could own your guilt because... Mm-hmm. I didn't give that to you. This is my reality, and I share my reality for the same reason that you just said, which is we can never be better, like, just as a culture, if we don't talk about the realities of our culture. And you don't have to take it personally to know that you personally are involved in a system. Like, the thing that you can take personally is sort of the demands you put on yourself, you know, for any guy that's responding to you talking about being a woman that does your job with, like, well, it's not more difficult. Like, you know, why don't you have a high enough opinion of yourself to try to change something, sir? That's what I would ask.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's kind of a through theme for many things, right? It's the, how come I can't use the N-word? Or why do people care if I say that people are the R-word? It's really just a choice of, why do you need to say that? If people tell you how it makes them feel, if people tell you that this is their reality and these are their experiences, what good does it serve you to just dig your heels in and refuse to accept their experiences and their feelings and their beliefs? It's just the idea of being made uncomfortable by having to cater to anyone other than you and your own demographic, which is a massive problem right now.
Yeah, I think, yeah. And I would take that one step further, which is that, I mean, I think you're totally right. And then I also think that cater to, that phrase could also be replaced with empathize. Like,
right.
That's literally what you're being asked to do, is just to have empathy. And the thing that empathy allows you to do is to also experience things you wouldn't be able to experience otherwise. So, like, that's kind of what I was talking about at the very beginning when we were talking about the way that I grew up, and it was very one way and one thing. And now in my adulthood, I mean, I crave learning new things and having my eyes opened. It doesn't mean it's always easy. I mean, I can have an emotional reaction just like the next person and feel overly patrolled sometimes. But I also would hate to do that, digging my heels in for the rest of my life, because, like, that's a lot of time to stay small, you know, it's difficult to hold the walls in around you. It's a lot of energy to spend not trying to understand other people.
If you have empathy, it hurts when people tell you that you're making them feel bad. It's embarrassing and shameful. But if you don't have any shame, then you're like, nah, don't care.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is part of the problem.
No, you're totally right. Yeah.
What would you say was your big break in comedy?
Well, you know, it's tough because it's like the internet has changed things so much that there aren't really big breaks anymore that often. It's like a slow boil. But there have been moments that have shifted my visibility and leveled me up. And, you know, one of them is a year after I moved to Los Angeles, to the day, exactly 1 year after I moved to Los Angeles, I made my debut on like late night TV doing stand up. It was on Craig Ferguson's show when he had a show, and Jay Leno had also announced that he was leaving the Tonight Show that week. So he was the other guest. And there's a really amazing moment. Honestly, listeners just should kind of look it up because it is legitimately wild, where I was telling jokes, and then I sort of mentioned that Jay Leno wears denim, which is like definitely like a queer thing that I can relate to. And then Craig Ferguson asked me if I was calling Jay Leno a lesbian. And then I was like, well, you don't get that haircut without like some knowledge of the community. And then they invited me to go sit between them. And this is real. This is real. This was really on CBS. This was really on CBS.
And Jay was enjoying it. He wasn't
offended. They were all having fun. Like, they were ribbing me and kind of heckling me and testing me, which I actually took as like a compliment from other comics, because it's certainly not something you see on television very often, but it definitely speaks to like them kind of seeing me as enough of a professional that I could handle it, if that makes sense.
Right. Absolutely.
It was kind of wild. Like, a lot of articles were written about it and stuff. And that's very strange because nobody writes about a stand-up comic being on late-night television. It's, like, not a thing.
Right.
But
right,
that was
right.
an auspicious beginning or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, Jay Leno just turns to camera and goes, old white men are out, lesbians rule. And then there was, like, the worldwide pants slogan.
What?
I mean, logo.
What year was this?
Yeah, 5 years ago, so 2013.
Wow. That's amazing.
I know.
He was ahead of his time, really. On the old white men being out.
Just like, I mean, it's also just like, what? Like, I mean, again, do I need to write? This is on CBS. Just Jay Leno saying directly to camera, lesbians rule, was on CBS. It was pretty wild.
All right. I'm going to go with that as the big break. Whether or not that was part of the slow boil, I say own it.
Yeah.
It's just a good story. Just always go with that.
It's a great story.
So you've gone on to do a bunch of other late night shows. You have a show with your spouse, Rhea Butcher, Take My Wife, that's bounced a couple different places, but has now resettled again, right?
Yeah, it's on Stars, which is great. We're
awesome.
Really happy about that.
So a new season coming out when?
We don't have any plans for a new season right now.
Okay. All right.
What I'm excited about is that folks can see it. It's on iTunes. It's also on Stars. And then also Rhea and I are already working on other projects, but that project is so personal to us because it's a version of our real lives. And it was originally on a streaming service that was owned by NBC Universal that they pulled the plug on, like the streaming service
went
under.
So
some of the shows like never made it out from there, you know, like kind of got pulled under and stayed under. And we were very happy to move over to Stars and to iTunes because, you know, the saddest thing would have been it's like not the best if your life is thrown in the trash.
Yeah. You want people to be able to still have that thing, like wherever they can get it, like still have that thing, like proof that you made it and have it age and change and you know, be able to still go see it. Yeah, for sure.
Exactly. So it was really positive.
So the new special is called Rape Jokes, and you were kind enough to have my husband and I come see one of the shows in Chicago as you were kind of prepping all the material and going around to different places figuring out what the exact set would be for the special. Why this show now?
Well, I mean, shortest answer, the president. Yeah. I found it very difficult. You know, I'm a survivor of assault, and I found it really difficult to hear the person who currently is our president say the things that he said about women. And, you know, I heard them from his mouth. You know, that Access Hollywood tape, I think about it still every day, because for me, there was something so familiar in his tone, you know, in the way that he was speaking about women. I just totally recognized it. I really understood what he meant. And then, you know, afterward, he backtracked and tried to change it and tried to say this was, you know, locker room talk or whatever. But I felt like I learned everything I needed to know about him in that clip. And I felt really dehumanized by it. I felt like an object. And this is somebody who is, you know, legislating my rights and representing me to the world. So I have had a very hard time during this presidency. And I was sort of waiting for someone in the comedy world to just step forward and speak in the first person about assault and harassment, because I have actually been so excited, and it's been so beautiful to watch these people tell their stories for the first time. The Me Too movement has made me feel like I'm not out of my mind for still caring about what happened to me, you know, and it has made me focus on survivors in a way that I don't think I've been encouraged to do in the past. Our culture really focuses a lot on what the perpetrator has to lose and, you know, how, whether or not it was as bad as was said. And there's a, you know, a lot of, they say this thing, they say this other thing, was it consensual, was it not consensual? And none of those arguments really address the emotional effect of being dehumanized or being overpowered. So that's a very long answer, but stand-up comedy is a great way of getting folks to meet you and care about you. And I just felt like there must be some social good to having folks hear my story and have it be funny and have me be charming, and maybe for them to keep me in their minds when they thought about this, so that it's not an existential issue, but a human reality.
Yeah, you know, Lindy West in her book Shrill talks about her very public battle with comedians about rape jokes. And one of the things she said is to tell people that they have to sacrifice some of their humanity and their self-respect to be part of the club. That excludes people, right? That for women who are survivors or for women who just care about other survivors, to have to sacrifice the part of themselves that doesn't find joking about sexual assault to be funny, that takes them out of that club of people that get to enjoy the comedy. And it does feel like rape jokes, and you obviously named it that for a reason, have been this really controversial thing, because we like to say that you should be able to joke about anything, that the whole point of comedy is to turn anything on its head. But so many people do it wrong that they are thinking about it in the abstract. They're not thinking about the women in the audience, or potentially men as well, that are likely victims. And if they did think about the number of people in the room that had actually experienced it, they probably would think about their joke differently. But because we can make it so abstract and ephemeral, that way we don't have to acknowledge the pain that you're putting people through for the sake of what you consider comedy. But it's really hard, because, right, who gets to decide what's a good rape joke?
Of course. Who does get to decide what's a good rape joke? I have, you know, I've written about this and spoken about this for a pretty long time. This is the hour-long set is the first time I've responded to it with stand-up. But there was an episode of my television show, Take My Wife, that was called Rape Jokes. I used to write an AV Club column. I did an article in there. I, like, you know, blogged about this in the past. It's that I think there's a misunderstanding happening here. Number one, I think that it's been oversimplified that like women are on one side of the issue, men are on one side of the issue, and also that it's an issue, as opposed to like we were just talking about like a real human experience. And I also think that there are tons of dudes who do my job who don't want to cause harm, who don't tell jokes. But the easiest thing to do is to always portray a situation as if there are two stark sides, you know, as if it's a binary conversation where it's like, I want free speech. And someone else is like, shut up. Like, that's not, I've never really seen that conversation actually happen. What I've seen happen is that people in the audience have said, hey, could you write like a better joke about this? It's usually feedback. It's usually an evaluation of that person's material and performance, which is never, I really haven't seen this moment where an audience member or a comic, you know, like a female comic, says to someone, never joke about that ever. And you're disgusting for even thinking you could joke about that. I have seen, you know, I'm sitting through this show that I paid for, and I don't want to feel worse when I leave.
Right.
So could you try to like not make me feel worse? And, you know, I mean, that's really like the challenge that I put out to my fellow comics is that, of course, joke about whatever you want. There's no restriction, but know that there are some people in the audience who have, you know, especially around rape, who have more experiences than this with you. Experience with this than you. Like, there are always going to be survivors in your audience. Always. Statistically, the answer is always. So, you know, hold yourself up to a high enough bar that you should make them laugh. Like, yeah. Aren't you trying to be able to connect to all people? And I don't mean that, like, because you're generic. I mean because you are so specific that everyone can relate to you.
Mm. Yeah. You know, I wonder if you have an answer for why rape jokes are defended so vehemently while racist jokes seem to be accepted as, you know, over the line. Now, there is for sure some racism that still seeps into people's sets, but it feels like everyone knows where the line is there for the most part, and people are unwilling to accept any line when it comes to misogyny and sexual assault jokes.
I don't know. I mean, I actually think that that kind of varies. It's wild, like, what there are trends. There are trends in what we will accept and what we won't accept. Like, for this period of time, we can tell homophobic jokes and then that goes out of style, but we can tell transphobic jokes. Or, right. Like, we can no longer use the N-word if we're white, unless we intentionally use the N-word because we're so woke that we use the N-word. Like, I just think there's... It's such a shifting, it's like trying to catch a snake or something. It's like, I kind of have always been outside of that because I'm not trying to get away with something. I'm trying to evolve and speak to the moment. And I guess maybe the reason that there is a gulf, you know, like you're saying, in people taking this seriously is because nobody's feet were held to the fire and some folks resist evolution.
Yeah.
Like that's just true. There are people in my industry who are surprised that they can't use the same words that they used 20 years ago on stage. And that feels like a restriction to them.
Right. That feels odd for this particular business. This job, right? It feels like it requires so much understanding of what's now and current that you're just rejecting that?
I think so. I mean, I think for me, it feels so false to have a problem with using updated terminology or with speaking to the moment because we really don't do that elsewhere. I mean, it honestly would be like somebody trying to like play in the MLB and they're like, no, I don't do any contemporary training, and I'm mad at you because these other people are doing contemporary training. You know what I mean? Like, it's like
yes.
People being like, No, someone else is doing yoga, but I will never do yoga. And I'm angry that yoga is affecting their swing positively. Like, it's just like, why are comics allowed to act that way? I mean, no other business people are allowed to act that way. You can't, like, hire someone and, you know, use some phrase with them that you used when you got your job, you know, in 1985 and just expect to keep your job. No.
Like, yeah, I'm going to fax that over right away. You can expect my fax immediately.
Exactly. Like, we're all moving forward all the time. I feel like it's a cop-out. It's like, it's this weird side of my industry that is the, I mean, you know, it's the straight white male echo chamber. Sometimes people that are straight white men, because we live in a culture that prioritizes that viewpoint over others, they can feel like, I mean, they get a lot of information back from people that fall in the same demographic. So it's like, if you want your voice affirmed, you and I can get on the phone and I can be like, I know it's hard for you to do your job, but there aren't that many places where you can get your voice affirmed. But if you are a straight white guy, there are a lot of places that you can get your viewpoint affirmed. So it just becomes like this, it's the frickin' toilet bowl that's never flushing. Like, that's why dudes think they can dig their heels in that do my job. Because nobody's saying to them, like, you are making yourself worse at stand-up. Just use updated words. Write about the things that are happening today. Good gravy.
Well, there was a very public sort of like understanding of that for Dave Chappelle. He came out of this long absence and a lot of people very publicly, including other comics, said he kind of acted like he Rip Van Winkled it. Like, you weren't in a coma. Like, you just stepped away, but you should have, you know, still aged along with the rest of us. And I think some of that showed up in his later specials, but the Me Too stuff, he still has some catching up to do. It sure feels like, to me at least.
I have a hard line on talking about other comics and other comics material. Like, I just don't do it.
Right.
But I think that what we're talking about here is that writing to the moment can be really positive. And I don't mean that you have to have my same perspective on the moment, but I think that you have to keep yourself updated. I just think even from like a, you could be, let's be really cynical about it. From a financial perspective, you're trying to sell tickets for people to come see you live. The people who go see live performance are in that 18 to 35 range. And as you age out of that, as an artist ages out of that, you better stay in touch with what those people want to see and how they talk. I don't mean like that I should come in with like newfangled teen language.
No, it's lit.
But that I literally cannot leave the youth behind because they are, that's who affects my bank account. So
if
you don't have a personal drive for social justice, I guess I'm giving other comics a cheat code where you can convince yourself by just thinking about
the negative impact.
Do it for the money. Do it for the money. If you can't do it because you have a soul, do it for the money.
That's going to be the title of the podcast.
Hey, everybody, don't forget to go to ESPN and Apple Podcasts and subscribe to That's What She Said with Sarah Spain so you always have the latest episode. Don't forget to rate and review it as well and tell all your friends how awesome it is.
I just was watching this fantastic Netflix special that I completely happened upon randomly called Nanette. It's Hannah Gadsby, this Australian comic. And one of the things she talked about was the feedback she got on one of her previous shows was not enough lesbian content. And, you know, all comedy is personal. And most don't consider it straight content when a straight comedian talks about dating or life or whatever. So understanding that the audience might receive your content differently, regardless of whether it's actually different, do you worry about a balance of how much am I talking about me personally in this life and this particular, the interactions that I have because of my sexuality, and how much do you say, whatever, this is just content that is about me, so take it as you want, lesbian content or otherwise.
Well, fortunately for me, and perhaps unfortunately for somebody else who is seeing things through a very narrow lens, I walk through the world with, you know, gay eyeballs. Like, I'm always experiencing the world gay. Like, I'm just gay all the time. So that means that it doesn't necessarily become the punchline or the setup of every single joke that I have, but my perspective is queer. And my perspective is also female, and I was also raised where I was, and I went to this kind of schooling. You know, like, I cannot divorce myself from my perspective. No comic can. And actually, this is, you know, we've been talking about this a lot kind of politically, nationally, over the last year with people, or a couple of years, with people having a weird problem with the idea of identity politics. Like, identity right. politics are negative. Just be neutral. And it's like, there is no neutral. We all have an identity. So my identity is present in my stand-up. And if I go see a straight dude, his identity is present in his stand-up. It's just invisible to us because it's a more normative perspective. Or it's overrepresented in my field.
Yeah,
so I think
sure.
it's like, you know, I mean, I guess I always say, I mean, number one, a ton of queer people come to see me do shows. Also lots of straight people. And I really think it's, at this point, kind of on the audience to evolve, because I consume a ton of straight media. It turns out if you turn on your TV, there's like a lot of straight people on there.
No way.
If you go to like a baseball game, there's like a bunch of straight people there. If you watch the Olympics, I know Adam Rippon is there, but there's like a lot of straight athletes. Like,
this is revelatory stuff.
Yeah. I consume and participate in straight media all the time. And I think that straight people letting themselves opt out or feeling threatened or stressed out. Like, sometimes people just go like, oh, can I even come to this? And I'm like, yeah, of course. Yes. Yes. Get in here. But know that, like, I'm not catering to you in a special way because you're not special.
Right.
And I'm not special. We're all just living the lives that we live.
Yeah. You know, one of the times recently you were out doing this set and kind of working your way through it, you got heckled by someone who wanted more comedy. And I wonder, when you're doing a special like this, which I found absolutely hilarious, but also way more of a revelatory experience because it was about important things and because it mattered more than just go seeing someone who's making jokes. How do you decide how often you need to break up some of the tenser, more genuine, honest moments with a laugh?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, this particular hour wasn't necessarily intended for a wide audience. What I mean by that is, I think it's intended for a wide audience to watch. I deliberately played in small rooms and didn't go on a big theater tour. I just played black box theaters, like where you saw me was, I think, a 50 or 100 seat theater. So I played places of that size. And that really was because I didn't know if I felt comfy charging for this and doing a full theater tour in every city in the country and having this sort of be like what everybody got from me that year, because I know it's like an intense topic for some folks. So like that is kind of separate actually than what you're talking about, which is that heckle happened at a big music festival in Boston, where there was also comedy called Boston Calling. And that happened very quickly after I just started talking about the president and how I think he is bad at business, which, by the way, on the tour prepping for Rape Jokes, the only other time anybody had a negative reaction was I walked people. I've never walked people in my entire career. That means they like got up and left the show. And it was, again, because I said that Donald Trump was bad at business. So I think that we are living in a real wild time where for some people in an audience, the most offensive thing that they can hear right now is not my story of sexual assault and not what this administration is doing to marginalized groups or the way in which we're setting ourselves up for potential economic failure on a global scale by like backing out of treaties and things like that. Like there are audience members who the most offensive thing they could hear is that our president is bad at business. And that is shocking to me. But it is information that I have to offer you.
Right. That's wild times. Yes.
Wild times.
So
I would think that's kind of like the least offensive thing you could say about that president, by the way.
Right.
Like if I was like going easy, I would be like, he's not good at business. Like that would be what I would say. And somebody's like, I'm leaving. I'm like, oh my God, have you watched anything in the last couple of years?
You are married to a fellow actor and comedian we mentioned earlier, Ray Butcher. When something funny happens at home, who gets the bit?
That's a good question. We don't call bits usually.
Dibs.
Yeah. I feel like what has happened sometimes is that one of us gets a really good joke and then it becomes like a signature joke. And then you sort of have to opt out at that point because you don't want to compete with something that's better than you. That's the worst. I think the only way that it really, like, we don't call bits. We made that agreement very early on. But I also don't necessarily publicly explore the things about marriage or being in a relationship because people know who Rhea is. And Rhea doesn't for me either. So when we're on stage together, because we perform separately, but then we also perform together at our show, Put Your Hands Together, and then we've also toured performing together. When we perform together, we talk about our relationship because then the other person has a chance to answer back, sort of a thing,
right.
Where I can be like, you are terrible with the covers. And then Rhea can be like, you are very controlling with the covers. You know, like, and we can have like that. That feels fine to me, but I don't feel like I can talk about Rhea without Rhea being there. So that's the only restriction that has evolved from our relationship is just that it turns out relationship material is like real golden. Like it's like a real golden egg and I don't have a ton of access to that and that's fine. But I didn't know in advance.
Yeah. You shouldn't have made the deal and now it's too late. And now.
Yeah, exactly. I can't crap on my wife in public. My life is terrible.
Now your only bits have to be you crapping yourself.
Exactly.
Which is actually in her special. So run and see.
Yeah. Totally. Totally.
They're all going to go watch now.
Yes.
Yeah. And I also, you know, we mentioned earlier, we were talking about the idea of why people find it to be such a disturbance to their lives to have to care about others and empathize with what makes other people's lives better and more comfortable and easier. And I know Rhea recently announced that that they were going to use the pronouns they. And for some people, that's it angers people, right? And I wonder, as you are kind of going through that with Rhea, what you've noticed about how it makes people feel.
Yeah, I mean, we might be a little bit lucky in that our jobs are very strange because we interact with audience members and then friends and then family. So because there isn't like a traditional office setting that stand-up has, we don't really spend a lot of time in places where folks wouldn't care about us. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
That's not how it started.
It's very like, lucky,
when I started
too.
Doing,
right.
I'm unbelievably lucky, and I know that. So when I go and I travel, especially with queer folks that live in a place where they might feel more marginalized, like I try really hard to be there for that person because I know that we are unbelievably lucky. I also didn't anticipate this. When I first started doing stand-up, it was really the opposite. I was like kind of never the outsider because I really started in rooms where there were no other queer comics and there were very few women. Like there was one other woman when I started in Chicago, 200 men. So I have always been like real alone. But now that has flipped a little bit at this point in my career and then also Rhea's career. So I think that there is potential for people to have that reaction that you're talking about, which is anger, we are seeing that less. I think what we see more often is just that it's like a new thing. And so I think folks are still getting used to it, and that's fine. You know, I mean, I don't want to speak for Rhea. I will say my experience of it is that that's fine, that folks need to get used to something.
Yeah.
But yeah, I know that what I just said is not true for a lot of people.
It does make a huge difference.
There are a lot of people who are like in danger, who are unsafe.
Right. It is the most grateful thing you can have is like not being surrounded by people that actively hate you or that you hate. I constantly am grateful for the fact that I don't have to be forced to spend time with a bunch of coworkers every day that I despise or family that I hate or anything like that. I mean, it's a real blessing that everyone should be very thankful for if they have it.
And also that you can be intentional about creating. That doesn't mean it's achievable for everyone. Because there are certainly a lot of reasons why I have a lot of privilege in that I got to choose what my job is. And a lot of people for a lot of different reasons don't have that choice, but I don't know. I kind of put my life together in a way where, you know, I came from a background where it was really not okay for me to be gay. And I, you know, it was terrible coming out. And then I just made the conscious choice to try to create more safety for myself as I continued through my life. Hmm. And that there are a lot of people that can't do that. But for me, I was able to do it and it worked.
Yeah. All right. Before I let you go, you have to do the one thing that everybody does, but nobody expects.
Didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
It's the Spanish Inquisition. Number one, what's the natural talent you'd like to be gifted with?
Musical talent.
Of any kind.
Because I'm a good actor. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Keep going.
Number two, what's your desert island album? You can only have one.
Oof. It's hard.
This is the worst question ever.
Yes. I think it's like, I mean, because I know, because it's also the terrible punishment of this is that you would hate this album. So if it's your favorite, then right. You immediately would hate it, which is really tough. But I think maybe it's like Tegan and Sarah Heartthrob. Let's do that.
Okay,
sorry,
good
Tegan
one.
And Sarah, I don't mean to hate your album pretty soon.
Number three, if you could switch lives with anyone for a day, who would it be?
I'm really curious about what Lena Waithe's life is like right now.
Yes, she's crushing it.
She's crushing it. Also, she seems extremely busy. I want to know how she's scheduling her life. That's what I want.
Has she figured out how to clone herself is really the key to that interaction right there. Number four, what's the most scared you've ever been?
I mean, I'm going to interpret this as like not real fear, like not like real safety fear, but like just like scared.
And whichever you want.
Feeling, and that feeling of just being scared is every day of my life. After it gets dark outside.
What?
Yeah. I like can't watch horror movies. I constantly think I'm going to be murdered. I am for sure an adult woman who's really functional, who's also afraid of the dark.
That's really unfortunate.
And that's fine.
Do you have nightlights?
It's fine. No, like I'm kind of fine in
it's
a
like
bedroom situation because by that time, like I have like a whole routine that involves like, you know, checking.
Right.
To make sure there's nobody in the house, locking things. Yeah. No, it's,
That sounds thrilling to be around.
It
all
is.
Every night.
It is nice.
Number five, what's the most embarrassed you've ever been?
High school, fell down all the stairs and skirt over my head. I had to go to the nurse because I got so hurt.
Oh, no.
Ugh, that was the worst part is that I couldn't just like shake it off and go to class. I had to go to the nurse.
Oh, that is terrible.
Oh, my God. Terrible.
I fell down the stairs during the audience-filled dress rehearsal for the talent show, dressed in all sequins as Donna Summer singing Last Dance with an afro. So,
oh, my God, right?
Yeah, I've been there.
Yeah, I know. It was passing period. Literally every student was in the hall.
Oh, no.
And I just fell down, like so many stairs. So many stairs. Did a full somersault.
Oh, no.
It was, like, bleeding, bruised. Oh. My knees started swelling. It was nuts.
School uniform?
Oh, yeah, school uniform. That's right. Yeah,
perfect.
Exactly. School
Great.
Uniform flying
I just
up
want
over
a picture.
My head. Yeah. incredible.
Number six, what would you consider your biggest failure?
My biggest failure? I once bombed in front of 30,000 people at Ooh. The World Music Theater, or whatever it's called now, the Tweeter Center. What's that place in Tinley Park?
I think it I is know. The Tweeter Center, yeah.
Yeah, I bombed
Tinley
in front of 30,000 people there.
Wow. Bad audience, bad material?
I mean, I think that I don't know that I was particularly set up for success at that show. I did perform the next night at a similar venue, size-wise, and then outdoor in Michigan somewhere, and that went really well. And thank God for that. Because
I was gonna say, how hard would that be with the same material the next night? Like, it's going to be better now.
Yeah, I mean, but that's what you have to do. That's the whole job of stand-up, is to delude yourself into thinking tonight will be better.
Yeah. Number seven, what habit or quality do you think has contributed most to your success?
Rejection makes me work harder.
Hmm.
In business and in work. Not like in personal.
Yeah, that,
not like with friends. Not like if you're like, I hate you. I'm like, now I'm your friend even more. But
we're breaking up. Mm-mm, we're getting married.
Yeah, exactly. But in business, rejection is not a...
Yeah,
rejection
that's good for
amped.
That for that career, for sure.
It is good.
Number eight, have you ever been in a fist fight?
Yes.
And? Details.
One was in sixth grade because somebody messed with my friend. And then one when I was probably 21 because somebody called me a gay slur. Those are my two.
That's
I did not do a great job either time.
You did not win? You're fairly petite.
The other person didn't win either. It just kind of
okay.
went badly. It's like just two untrained idiots. Yeah, just like essentially like slapping, you know, fingers in the middle. Like just like,
right.
Blah, 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 blah.
Right.
Yes. Like that kind of thing.
Number nine, what's the thing about yourself you'd most like to improve?
My capacity for taking joy in success.
Hmm.
I'm really good at being motivated by failure, but I have a hard time allowing myself to see success.
Yeah, you know, that seems to be common for a fair amount of successful people I talk to, which is sort of sad. It's like maybe that's why they're successful, because they can never just settle and enjoy. But that's also kind of sad, if you know.
Yeah, it is sad. I will say it feels real sad to live inside of it. But... I guess the first stage is self-awareness about it, right?
For sure. Yeah.
So there's that.
That's good. If you know about it, you can try to force your brain synapses to change so that you're easier to access that satisfaction, that pride.
Yeah, totally.
And number 10, what three words would you most hope that people would use to describe you?
Oh, my God. Okay. Funny. That's literally number one.
Mm-hmm.
Compassionate. That's number two. And this one is going to sound really not humble. So if I had a fourth one, it would be humble. But the third one is visionary. Because
Ooh.
I really would want folks to think that I can see a better future for us, and that's
yeah.
why I am motivated to be funny, and that's why I'm compassionate, because I have a vision for future. So, yeah. But if you say, I want you to consider me a visionary, you sound like an a- but
no, I like it. It actually reminds me of your Wikipedia that I was looking at that called you a groundbreaking in lesbian content creation, but someone had put according to whom after the groundbreaking. Because they said that word is often too vague and subjective.
Wait, that's like in my Wikipedia?
It's in your Wikipedia.
According to whom? I gotta look this up.
It says, Esposito is known for her groundbreaking, parentheses, according to whom, lesbian content creation.
Oh my God.
Wait, and then it has a link to something called a weasel word. Unsupported attributions. Weasel words are words and phrases aimed at creating an impression that something specific and meaningful has been said, when in fact only a vague or ambiguous claim has been communicated.
Oh,
so anyway, there
my
you
God.
Go.
Oh, my God.
I'm
going to
put,
oh,
you know, a visionary
God.
According to whom.
I love this so much. I'm so glad I know about this. I'm taking a screen cap of this right now. This is so funny. I kind of want to die. I like it. It's so funny. It's perfect. Oh my God.
I like it too. I mean, certainly the ladies who walked out of your set do not find you to be a visionary or groundbreaking. So, you know, according to whom, Cameron?
According to whom? That's so funny. Thank you for telling
yes,
me.
Yes. Yes. Well, on that, I'll let you go, because you've given me my last question, which is, who should I have a conversation with? And it's clearly Bobcat Goldthwait. I need to make that happen.
Yeah. Have a Bob conversation. Is what I was just going to say to you out of my human mouth. But yeah, you should talk to Bob. He's
awesome.
A cool person.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks for hanging out with me. You're the best.
It was really nice to talk to you. Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, and another thing.
This week's That's What She Read is not actually a read. I love sending you guys to read articles, but I more than anything want to send you to go watch Hannah Gadsby's Netflix special called Nanette. I was on a binge of Queer Eye, the new season, in a hotel stuck for work, and it got to the end of the season, and I was like, what am I going to watch next? And Netflix said, here, watch this. And I have never heard of Hannah Gadsby. I had no reason to dive in except for Netflix suggesting it. I clicked and decided to start watching, and I immediately was drawn in by this comedian. This woman is unbelievable, and this special is just groundbreaking. I cannot say it enough. No matter who you are who is listening to this right now, go watch this show. It's a stand-up. It's mostly comedy, but she also has an incredible history of her life and growing up in Tasmania as a lesbian, and that was illegal there, I believe, until 97. She's also an art history major, and she understands sort of the mythology of art, but also the ways in which art had so limited a representation of the real world, and especially of women. And it's hilarious and funny and smart, and she's an incredible speaker and a powerful voice, and I tell you, it's going to change you if you watch it. So that is my recommendation. It's a demand, actually. You have to watch it. You must go now. Hannah Gadsby's Nanette on Netflix. And thanks, as always, for lasting about an hour with me.